Welcome to Artists and Ancestors, the podcast where we explore ways to research and understand the past. Whether you're a local historian, genealogist, or just interested in everyday creative lives of people from the past, this podcast is for you. I'm John Kay, the host of Artisan Ancestors. Hello and welcome to episode 34 of Artisan Ancestors. In this episode, I talk with folklorist Roby Cogswell about his research of the basket-making traditions of Cannon County, Tennessee. This amazing craft has long been one of Tennessee's best-kept secrets. We talk about his use of both fieldwork and genealogical methods to uncover an untold story of this long-standing white oak tradition. Roby has recently published an article about the Cannon County tradition in the Tennessee Folklore Society Journal, but nothing can compare to listening to him talk about his research. However, as Roby would say, you don't ask him the time if you don't want a history of watchmaking. So, this episode's a little longer than usual, but I think it's exactly the content that artists and ancestor listeners are looking for.
I'm Roby Cogswell. I am the director of the Folk Life Program at the Tennessee Arts Commission. I began here in 1984. At that point, it was the Folk Arts Program, and we changed the name about 12 years ago. And in looking at outstanding Tennessee traditions, even at my arrival, I have always known that Cannon County was really an exceptional place, and sort of felt like there was no other place in the country with the kind of productivity and local significance for basket making and chair making as Cannon County. And it's not the kind of thing that I could easily drop out of my job and do nothing but research for months on end. But I was intensely interested in it and sort of constantly acquiring documentation, interviewing new people that I met, finding old baskets and finding stories and connections about them. And so I've really, just in the last couple of years, resolved to really get written up a lot of the material that I have. I don't think I'm anywhere near the bottom of it. It's an astonishingly complex local tradition and historically very deep, but I felt that it was time to get a lot of this stuff down. Interviewed a lot of ladies, and that's where most of this started. I had already been inclined to do historic craft research in the old days before any of that was online, you know, wading through county records and stuff like that the old-fashioned way, and it's slow going. And I'd always intended to get deeper into some of the stuff in Cannon County, taking the threads that women had told me in these interviews about their mothers, their grandmothers, and of course realizing that there was this incredible dynamic between a cluster group of families intermarried over just decades and decades, and had always thought that I should do more genealogy. And I've recently, in the past couple of years, been in partnership with another IU folklorist, Brent Cantrell, who is now director of one of our best nonprofits in Tennessee, Jubilee Community Arts in Knoxville. Brent happens to be from the next county over, and he's a diehard genealogist. Started out interested in his own family in Warren County, which is right next to Cannon County, and actually shares some of this tradition in the sort of target zone of this tradition. I started feeding stuff to Brent, and lo and behold, he started coming up with these additional deeper connections in civil records and so forth. And I knew I had him hooked when I started receiving emails from him that were timed in at 2 o'clock in the morning. But he has he's really taken the ball and pushed it even further. Latest count, we have over 200 basket makers and chair makers identified with certainty in Cannon and these contiguous counties. Some of that's from census records going back to the 1860s. And this research phase has been an interesting expansion of my understanding of the tradition. All of the explanations on the ground in recent years have been, well, this is how these folks got through the hard years of the Depression. And that had to do with the fact that it was in the memory of the surviving masters that I was able to interview, and that was part of their personal experience. And come to find out, in census records, we have this really fortuitous situation where there's profuse documentation of people's craft occupation. Sometimes, you know, if you look at old census records for craft information, it's, you know, there's a guy, you know, he was a great chair maker and he's called a farmer, that kind of thing. For some reason, in the 8th District of Cannon County, and Brent has a whole theory about this, he thinks it's a woman census taker, I think it's 1900, might be 1890, was very aware that this wasn't just a housewife. This woman was a basket maker. And so she called her basket maker in the civil records. And after this woman kept taking the census, subsequent census takers were also attuned to that in this particular district. It's not comprehensive. I'm sure there were basket makers and chair makers who didn't get recorded as such in the census. But just the fact that it happened and that the people compiling the public records were attuned to this to a certain degree has provided us these great glimpses of how widespread this really was. It was the context of these crafts had implications on how it could be documented, how it was passed on, and so forth. Generally, there was a male tradition of chair making. And we've become increasingly aware of moonshining and bootlegging as well, and female traditions of basket making. And so as we're looking at the civil record, we've got this sort of inverted situation where the female lines are what matters the most in tracking the legacies of these women in basket making. But of course, the fact that most of these women took their husband's last name, it's provided a twist in the civil records as far as documenting it. And even if we talk about the Manus family or the Thomas family or the Davis family traditions, ultimately these female craft legacies go back deeper, and they don't really conform to the family association that they have in recent years.
Well, that's totally fascinating. Just amazing that you're doing two things there. You're actually using the census records, but you're also, through the census records, actually finding a much more democratic history because you have the records of these women there, and you have the records of a female tradition that often that part gets stripped away. I know here in Indiana, the oak rod basket is presumably a male tradition that died out in the 1970s, actually.
The Bohall family?
The Bohall and the Hovis families were the two making those baskets. And all types of rumors about, you know, the men would only teach men, the women wouldn't, they never taught the daughters so that they would keep it in the family. I think there's a lot of, quote, folklore to that. I see
yeah, we've been interested in that too, and the while the gender associations were the rule, we found all kinds of exceptions. One of the most talkative and insightful informants among what I'm labeled the grand generation, that is the last great group of basket makers who are now, there are only two of them left, and they're both in their 90s, and they both quit making in the past few years. But in that peer group, Albert Thomas was this incredible exception, and come to find out that his mother was a great basket maker, and she had three boys, you know. And so, by George, they helped her out, and they learned the craft. There was another woman that I finished the write up for the second article. I didn't meet her. I didn't interview her. She died in the early 1950s, but she was an astonishing woman, Eliza Jane Mears Thomas, and she had very few daughters, but she had a passel of sons. And she was a trainer. She ran a virtual factory with young kids that she taught to make baskets, and she was a strict taskmaster. One of the surviving basket makers in recent years, Gertie Youngblood, was Eliza Thomas's granddaughter. Her parents died at an early age, and she was essentially adopted by her grandmother. And you know, she testifies that you know, living at Eliza's house was pretty close to child labor. You know, when we didn't go to school, by George, we were working on baskets by 9 o'clock in the morning, and we worked until dark. And there was a weekly cycle of making the baskets, then taking them in to trade at the store for groceries and staples and stuff. So Eliza Thomas was she trained a bunch of male influences on the next few decades, and those guys, you know, later on they helped daughters learn, or they married female basket makers, and there was, you know, there was a stasis about the generational roles, but it wasn't hard and fast. And there were also many of these women who as youngsters worked in their dad's chair shops alongside their brothers and so forth. The last woman that I just finished writing up married Mary Jane Prater. She's still alive, you know, and she was very proud of the fact that she was a tomboy, and she was as tough as any of her brothers, and she would she made chairs right along with them, you know. So that was, you know, that was an interesting set of insights into the fact that the gender associations were not absolute at all, and to a certain extent, the use of a common natural resource also helped to define male roles in the basket making. That is, they were all using white oak for both chairs and baskets. Baskets required a younger type of timber, and timber that would pull more easily for the splits, but still, a household which had both basket making and chair making going on at the same time, usually the men brought in the basket timber and they busted it out and even did some of the splitting to help their wives. On the other hand, there's some women who remember, especially in households where they were also running booze and the men were boozers and engaged in illegal activity, there's considerable resentment along gender lines that their pappy and their grandpappy were more interested in the booze than helping mom. And poor mom had to go out and cut her own timber and with the kids make the baskets to put groceries on the table, you know. So the gender thing was a very interesting twist in all this.
Before we get any deeper in this, why don't you tell me where Cannon County is in Tennessee and describe these baskets. What type of baskets are we talking about?
Cannon County is in eastern Middle Tennessee. If you know anything about Tennessee geography, it's at the intersection of two geographic areas of the state. What's called the Central Basin is lowland topography with limestone right under the soil. And it was an early large farm settlement area. Matter of fact, the northern part of the Central Basin was very closely akin to the bluegrass area of Kentucky. That kind of settlement, early plantations, and in the case of Tennessee, it was more tobacco than anything else. But it fostered larger scale agriculture of the 19th century. Stones River watershed goes through the county. The county seat is Woodbury. It's immediately east of Murfreesboro, Tennessee. But the basket making and chair making area is just up from the Central Basin in that area, in what's called the Highland Rim. And this is the first step in elevation. It eventually, if you're going east, it will go up to the even higher elevation of the Cumberland Plateau. But Highland Rim was generally scrubby land. It wasn't particularly desirable, and it was folks with less money, you know, more marginal folks lived out there. And Brent turned up an incredible incredible quote from a local history talking about one particular area near this was called Pea Ridge, and it's a testimonial. The guy saying, "Yeah, some of them made baskets and chairs and whiskey, and it was generally a tribe of board makers," which was a great quote. Of course, in the early days, the splitting of board shingles. They were not called shakes in the South; they were boards, and so this kind of marginal subsistence activity was one of the it's a real cluster of traditional skills that provided these folks with a survival in this area. Interestingly, later in the tradition, there was this incredible highway that came through, actually what was called the Broadway of America. It was US 70. Initially, it was the Bristol to Memphis Highway, but suddenly there was this route of transportation in the 20s that really kind of jolted the area with exposure to the outside world. And it certainly helped them haul off these these truckloads of baskets and chairs, which the place was even better known for after that development. So anyway, it's called Cannon County. It's in the eastern, the craft region is in the eastern part of Cannon County, and it's kind of a diaspora. It's also implicates a lot of rural communities in Warren County to the east, to a certain extent, some up in DeKalb County. In more recent years, a lot of these folks have moved to Smithville and larger towns in some of the surrounding counties, but it's still the Cannon County diaspora. The baskets are split white oak in two dominant patterns. One is the round rib pattern, so-called egg basket, and the nomenclature is completely out the window. There are a lot of variations to the names for different specific varieties of baskets, but in general, the round rib or egg basket, and then the related box basket, which has more perpendicular angles to it. It's an oblong or box basket that resembles egg basket, but it doesn't have rounded contours. It has closer to 90 degree contours. Of course, in actual practice, a lot of makers rounded the edges of their box baskets as well, and lots of other varieties. A half of a rounded basket was usually hung up on a wall. That was usually called a wall or a key basket. A flat bottom basket with almost no depth to it was called a pie basket or a cake basket. There were horn baskets. There were a lot of minor forms that some makers made and other makers didn't make. But in comparison to the other great eastern Anglo white oak area, which was up to the north in Kentucky, from the Mammoth Cave area up to a community called Wax in Grayson County, Kentucky. Those folks made baskets in much the same way as in Cannon County, and the economics of the situation were similar. But generally in Kentucky, the hoop components, the handle and the top rim hoop, are brought together not only with X cross bracing, but also with a little element that's sometimes called a God's eye or a ear. That's not done in Cannon County. In Cannon County, the bracing is only X. And in earlier years, when baskets were commodities and these folks were trading at the local grocery stores to get by, there was not a lot of concern with authorship or identity of the craftsperson. They knocked out baskets and they sold them to be used, and they were pretty rough. That's a word you hear a lot in people recalling older basketry. Rough baskets or common baskets. And sometimes I just was rereading a quote not long ago in this last piece of writing that I did. Mary Jane said, "The head splits thick as your finger." And what happened in the 70s with this, what I've dubbed the Grand Generation, is that these ladies had they quit making baskets after about World War II or in the 1950s. The market fell apart. There wasn't much money to be had in it. And these local textile mills came in. And lo and behold, you know, these women had a, they were very handy, you know, and they were hired by these shirt factories and in both Woodbury and McMinnville. And many of them were ashamed of making baskets because it was associated with poverty. Some of them told me they didn't want their children to learn how to make baskets because it was a social stigma. And then towards the end of their lives or in their senior years, they kind of changed their tune a little bit. There was a little bit of interest in the tradition and better prices. And what went along with that was this incredible revival of the craft in its aesthetic terms. These women started making really fancy baskets, what was usually dubbed show baskets, with much finer splits and details and all kinds of specializations. Tiny, tiny miniatures, baskets the size of a dime, nested sets of baskets going up to 12 or 15 sitting inside each other, a lot of experimentation with dyed splits, some innovations, complete variations of form, built on traditional forms, but really just fantastic ideas. One of the ladies that's still living, Martha Jones, invented what she called a dolly basket. This was an oblong basket that put round rib type bulges on the sides of an oblong basket, matching on each side. And of course, it was she named it after Dolly Parton's figure, and even used decorated splits to, in effect, weave in a bikini top to show off these bulges on the side. You know, it's just what a mind-blowing innovation, you know, but you know, this lady had just made so many baskets, you know, she just said, "Well, I could do that, make this, do this," you know. And the really interesting thing during this period is incredible competition between these women. It was not really about the money. It was about who can impress their peers. Very, very personal, sort of private story with all of these women and how they regarded it. In many cases, there was this just wonderful emotional attachment to their upbringing and working with their mothers and their grandmothers. Even though it was hard times, you know, they were wonderful memories. And as they, you know, took this back up in some of them in the 50s, 60s, even 70s, you know, there was a strong personal association with just the doing of the craft. And it was a very loose-knit community. And, you know, as a documentarian, I'd find out about somebody and I'd interview them and sort of pull their story out. And But there wasn't a whole lot of volunteering of other people's identities and associations, you know. And then later on, I'd find out that, you know, that this other woman I just discovered was in fact a cousin of the woman that I wonder. Well, gosh, why didn't she tell me about her? You know, that's okay. You know, it's the way life is in a community. You know, and the other complicating thing is that going back to the time of social stigma, the onus of having to trade baskets at the grocery store for food, and of course it was like a coal camp, you know, it was a company store kind of a deal. They needless to say, they didn't get a good exchange on that, and the store owners were sort of kings of the local community. And they would stockpile baskets and be involved with outfitting peddlers to take those baskets off and sell them somewhere. But by the 30s, social support programs became involved, welfare, disability programs, and so forth, eventually food stamps, and even, you know, Social Security payments and so forth. The sales of baskets in the newer market violated supplemental income ceilings for a lot of those programs, and a lot of people didn't want to get busted and lose their check for making baskets. So there was, in fact, an extensive black market. And many makers, many makers didn't have very favorable rates of exchange and other issues. There's some very unscrupulous activity by some of these basket dealers, and they didn't have incentives to make the best baskets. And generally, a lot of those people, they made good baskets, and they were very representative of the tradition. But there were none of those makers who really did knock your eyeballs at work, you know. And so everybody had their own experience, but again, this is a community where, you know, moonshining went way back. There was a strong code of protection among people, and all of these folks knew what the situation was with their different friends and so forth, and they weren't you know, they respected each other's privacy. And so in many cases I would learn of a maker. I would recognize their work from seeing it before, long before I ever met them. And sometimes my attentions, as a guy who's driving around in a state car, you know, they were resented. You know, people ran from me, and I had to establish rapport and trust with folks and let them know, look, I have no intention of doing you any harm, and if you don't want to talk to me, I fully understand it, but you know, I'd like to know more about your basket making if you're willing to talk. So that was I had an ally in one of the local social workers who knew very well what was going on, and she was very sympathetic with their plight. And you know, she'd ask them if they were making baskets, and I hadn't made any baskets in 6 months, and of course she knew they were making baskets, but they got the check anyway in that case. But it was a really, really stark set of contextual realities that absolutely were out of phase with the assumptions of the craft fair network in the 1970s. And you know, people have often naively, you know, said, well, you know, why has the tradition not continued? You know, well, nobody can get paid enough to make baskets like that, you know. And the buyers of baskets were very distant from Cannon County, and there was a whole class of dealers and resellers who sort of came in and swooped things up and took them off and upped the price, you know, 400-500% usually. So it's a real reflection of the state of life in this marginal part of this Middle Tennessee county. And you know, from the standpoint of doing documentary research, genealogical documentation, you know, these are not the kinds of families that normally get represented in your first generation Goodspeed histories in the 19th century, you know. And it's a pretty interesting exercise in trying to put this together. And a lot of the current descendants are very intrigued by this. It's a kind of a reassessment of legacy. And one of the really interesting things is Brent has been, you know, Brent's engaged in the online genealogy networks, and he's been getting incredible photographs provided to him by descendants who are themselves, you know, researching family history and talking to people online and so forth. And one of the really breakthrough things in the second article that I'm coming out with is just this staggering documentation of these photographs, you know, just hundreds of baskets being hauled out of the county. And that began actually in, I think it's 1900 or 1910, we begin to see men identified in the census as occupation peddler of baskets and chairs. And that was, you know, that was the whole economy. You know, these were not wealthy people, and just the fact that there was any photo documentation at all was pretty interesting. And we have some, you know, photographs of families making baskets going back to about 1915, and then the basket wagons and trucks were, you know, pretty spectacular sights, you know, rolling down the highway to somewhere else. And among the men there was also this, it was almost a rite of passage for young guys to go off peddling baskets and chairs. You know, they'd haul these things to spots that they'd located in, you know, Lexington, Kentucky, Detroit, Birmingham, Memphis. You know, they'd set up on the highway at an outskirt on the outskirts of one of these cities, and just sell till they sold out. And it was pretty risky stuff. You know, they're sleeping under the truck. Some of them were probably running booze in the same truck, and you know, they were subject to getting rolled, or you know, they had the cash from their sales with them, and it was quite an adventure, and it was exposure to the outside world for a lot of these guys who were you know, in their teens and early 20s, beginning in the 20s on up through World War II. That was the great period of peddling out of Cannon County, and so it's a very, very complicated story of you know, individuals' experiences in one endeavor or another related to this whole local culture.
That's great. The interesting about the trucks, I've got a photograph from Brown County, Indiana, and I was going to send a copy of it to look at because I think it's Tennessee baskets that are on this truck. And it's parked right in Nashville, Indiana, which is a tourist destination, you know. And there were so many tourists that the local basket makers couldn't keep up with the demand.
Sure.
And so they started trucking them in to meet that tourist need.
Well, that happened in it happened in Lookout Mountain, and it happened in Gatlinburg too. You know, these were areas sort of known as an early Appalachian tourist destination, especially Gatlinburg, and almost all the baskets being made as local or sold as local baskets in Sevier County, Tennessee, were in fact from Cannon County, 150 miles away. You know, and how these market networks found out about this is you know, pretty incredible stuff. Some of it was the initiative of these peddlers just going out and trying to see where they could sell, making contacts as they could. Some of the peddlers actually would chart these really long itineraries and ship baskets and chairs to themselves up in Ohio, where they could reload after they had sold out their first load. And there were boxcar loads of baskets and chairs, according to some testimonies, going out of the McMinnville Railroad Station. The former Speaker of the Tennessee House of Representatives, John Bragg, told me his favorite story. There was a man from Woodbury who, sorry, I'm forgetting his name, but he moved to New York and made it big, and he was the president of the Chemical Bank of New York in the 19-teens, about World War One time, and he was reminded of his modest background when he was walking through Times Square and ran into a local guy that he knew from Woodbury hawking Cannon County baskets and chairs on Times Square. So it really, you know, it really, really was world famous. And I've just, you know, it's just a staggering number of just baskets that were made, just the sheer productivity. And I think one of the, you know, the thing that we're coming around to is actually finding, you know, for I've done these sort of pretty exhaustive profiles, or as exhaustive as I could make them, for about 18 of these makers. And you know, I would hear second cousins. You'd find an old obituary, and people were identified as basket makers sometimes, or references in not just censuses, other civil records as well. And you know, like I said, we're at about 200 something for sure, and who knows, there were probably two or three times that many people who you know, evaded any kind of documentation, but they were involved in this at one point in time or another.
And what's fascinating to me is that if you ask people about white oak baskets and that sort of thing, most people would never have heard of Cannon County. They would just say in the mountains or whatever, and not really think about the kind of a place being known for this type of community tradition.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, and there are a lot of things going on in that observation, and one of them that has it's sort of a pet peeve of mine as a Southern craft enthusiast. There's been a lot of attention lately to the so-called craft revival, Appalachian craft revival, and there were settlement schools and social missions in pretty much the highest part of the mountains, the most remote part of the mountains, beginning by the early 1900s. And what we have of folklore documentation in Appalachia is really interwoven with this story of outside interest in the Southern Highlands. The fact of the matter is that the craft revival was very uneven in how it affected things. And by and large, craft institutions, you know, brought in folks, the Jane Hull model of social betterment through good work. You know, they'd bring in people that were art school trained folks to come in and teach these poor Southerners their own traditions, you know. There were, you know, institutions with lives of many decades that they did good work in particular places, and they positively affected many communities and people. But the fact of the matter is, there was nothing like that in Cannon County. There was absolutely, it was purely entrepreneurial, free enterprise at work, along with some aspects of exploitation and other things that would be regarded as less favorable, certainly. But that's one reason why it's kind of a secret. Its history is not as easily penetrated, and it certainly wasn't locally celebrated or maintained. You know, that in other places. Where there are these kind of settlement school traditions, you know, there's a local museum and a lot of stuff's been handed down, and the fact that we're just, this stuff's just popping up out of people's scrapbooks and so forth, and or dug out of civil records, testifies to a very different kind of thing that was going on here. And by and large, chair making and basket making as well. You know, they show up in some of the documentation of the craft revival, but generally those were just exceptional craftspeople who these sites had some kind of relationship with, and they were able to show them off kind of like show pony. As far as really teaching that craft and having a real center of production of basket making or chair making, it really wasn't touched as much by the craft revival. And I think that happened elsewhere. Same thing happened with the sweetgrass basketry in South Carolina. You know, it was defined in a completely different way from the sort of mission connected thing that we see very very often. I don't know. It's sort of presented as a sole explanation for the survival of crafts in the Southern Highlands now, and it's simply not true. There were a lot of places that were not affected by it.
Very fascinating. I think that a lot of it's probably boiled into this idea of it being a wholesale export, where they're making them to sell to an intermediary who's going to sell them, and so to a certain degree, keeping this place a secret. From, or at least out of the public view, so that the mystique of the baskets can be rubbed off onto Gatlinburg or rubbed off onto Brown County or wherever it may be, is surely part of it, where you're taking someone else's cultural production and kind of hijacking it for your own economic use.
Yeah, my own experience as a folklorist was really slammed me into those considerations fairly early. In Kentucky, in the early 80s, I taught at University of Louisville for a while, and then I started doing public folklore work for the Kentucky Arts Council. And at that particular time, there had been this craft initiative begun by the First Lady, Phyllis George Brown, in Kentucky. And there were all kinds of schemes with department stores up north. But there was this state craft promotion program, and vestiges of that survive. It wound up being a pyramid of sorts, and really remarkable entrepreneur Phil Alvey. He was actually from one of the major basket making families up in the Wax area. But he gathered baskets and he wholesaled to a lot of different department stores and craft resellers and so forth. And you know, one of the problems with that, from the standpoint of folklorists, is that traditional artists really can't keep up with that. They cannot produce as wholesalers in ways that really benefit them for a number of reasons. In some cases, there are issues of literacy, empowerment, and other kinds of cultural wherewithal that prohibit it. But in the case in Kentucky, for example, is I was working up there with members of the Higdon family in Grayson County, Kentucky, and sort of putting two and two together about how this worked and how it had evolved. That all the white oak was played out. Been so many people making baskets that it was not obtainable the way it had been, you know, under a sort of a cultural commons mindset in earlier days, and people built more fences and they protected what white oak they had because modern ideas about forest harvesting and, you know, the sale of good logs for you know, barrel staves and other kinds of ventures, and people just couldn't get a hold of the young white oak. And in Kentucky, they were actually making baskets out of water maple, and it was kind of almost a joke among the makers. I mean, it was not a strong basket; it wasn't a stout basket, but it looked real pretty, and it was a sort of a white. And the timber would split. A lot of times, you had to look a little harder to get a piece of maple that would split. There were a lot of different things behind the production that were not transparent to the buyer, in this distance between the maker and the buyer, and what you're alluding to, this is that somewhere in that the object becomes a symbol, you know, and a romanticized set of associations. But that was going on in Kentucky, and I had attempts to by all kinds of people to sort of have me serve up folks that they could exploit, you know, and that's you know, that same kind of set of circumstances has certainly been at play in affecting Cannon County, not to the same degree, or there certainly wasn't a state program pushing it. You know, this whole thing of authorship has been a little bit touchy as well. Many of the dealers and some of the makers who in fact resold stuff from other people, it's hard to say how much of it was intentional or fraudulent, but you know, if you buy a basket from somebody and they look like they're from out in the country, you know, so well, this is their basket. Well, you know, they don't have to tell you they didn't make the basket. You know, that's an old thing where they come from. You know, let's get a wagon load of baskets together and sell them, you know. And so there are a lot of even in the documentation of basketry, there are a lot of misappropriations of things, and baskets are presented in some of the documentary books as being made by so and so, and you know, one of my first revelations in Cannon County was people saying, you know, they didn't make that basket, I made that basket. You know, there were a lot of hard feelings about that, when and feuds between neighbors and so forth, and when you know, when you're interviewing to set the record straight, by George, that's their first opportunity to set the record straight, and they let me know about that. And you know, there are other things going on as well. You know, could well have affected popular appreciation of it, but I will tell you what, when it got down to Heritage Awards, I nominated Maggie Murphy, who was sort of the grand old lady, she was not the best basket maker, but she had played a very important role in the revival of the basketry and so forth. And she was good-natured, and she was a wonderful character. And I nominated Maggie for a National Heritage Award. Then after the Epi Archuleta episode, in which Hispanic weaver in Colorado, as a result of her winning the National Heritage Award, had been busted from food stamps. I sort of felt a little obligated to have a conversation with Maggie. And, you know, didn't know if we could work something out, some kind of trust fund if she wanted for, you know, for money that she would receive. But she, man, she just turned on me. She just said, there is no way I want to even raise the possibility of losing my Social Support check. So she wanted me to withdraw her National Heritage nomination, and I did. But then as we looked further at it, the cast of characters and my relationship to them and their relationship to each other's got, you know, there's no way I'm nominating this woman and not nominating that woman, you know. So I stayed out of the nomination business because in part I really didn't know a lot enough about some of these relationships to really, you know, stick my head in that lion's mouth. Later on in the past 12 years, we've had a state heritage award, and we did honor Ida Pearl Davis and Thelma Hibden, a mother-daughter team who really did a lot of programming related to our projects and so forth, and they thoroughly deserved it. So we did get the tradition represented in our own program, but you know, a lot of it has to do with cultural differences, you know, between on the ground culture of the traditional craftspeople and whatever the assumptions and the dynamics of our institutional programs might be. But it's been a wonder to me why Cannon County is such a secret about this. And you know, meanwhile, we've got a really great local arts center in Cannon County that's done a lot of work, and they've really revived community pride in this whole thing. It's a little bit late, you know, but some younger local people are making noise about making baskets again, or at least being proud of their grandma. And that was not that again, as far as the institutional interface, that was not an easy thing to do. At the beginning, the local arts center had evolved out of a theater group, and there was a contemporary crafts person running it, and they couldn't really get the local craft community to feel ownership and that kind of thing. And a director was hired at the Art Center of Cannon County, who's a local guy. He's got a master's in theater, but you know, you scratch beneath the surface on this fellow, Donald Fan, and there's a folklorist under there, you know. And he and I did a lot of tag teaming over the years, and he realized that for their community arts program to really take ownership and relate to all segments of the county, they were going to have to embrace this and do it with a vengeance. And they've one of our efforts in that respect has been to try to build. They actually have a museum there now, and we have been building their collection of local basketry. It's one of those situations where even in my, you know, younger lifetime, I remember when I was young driving through Woodbury and they'd be selling baskets everywhere, you know, but they were all bought up and taken away, or they were all hauled up on a truck and sold to somebody else. So we've located some of these really knowledgeable and appropriate collectors from the real heyday of this revival in the 70s, and we found some spectacular collections of these women's work, and they've you know, we've brokered purchases or donations to the Arts Center Cannon County, and now they regularly exhibit just knock your eyes out stuff. So we finally had an institutional embracing of this on a local level that's has been a very welcome development.
That's great. I'm glad to hear it. I've been in Cannon County and hung out there, helped build some chairs there one winter break when I was a graduate student. I can honestly say I don't know that I've ever seen a Cannon County basket, even though I've been in Cannon County several times. So,
well, you can see them at the Art Center now. That's great. Yeah, you know, the interesting thing is I've always been very interested in chair making as well, and again, I think the whole thing started in interviewing people. So, well, I need to get your family's history on this, you know, and this lineal idea of craft descent and so forth. And suddenly, oh, your grandmother was a Manus. And then after a while, you realize this is not a lineal thing at all. This is a plate of spaghetti. You know, the interrelationships between these families and their craft descent lines was just staggering. And again, I've always been partial to chair making, and I had a great guy, very knowledgeable, young. I say young. He was in his 50s at the time. Chair maker, Buck Davis. And I had asked a lot of dumb questions to get into who knows what and useful information, but Buck could actually tell me what a Prater family chair from the 20s looked like, you know, or a Manus chair or a Thomas chair. And, you know, we said, well, I'm going to interview about all that. We're going to get a bunch of old chairs and we're going to get all this done. And a guy died of a heart attack at 57.
Oh, my.
And he's literally the only one of his generation who, you know, was systematic and intellectualized and interested enough to really have all that information in his head, you know. Mm-hmm. And Buck took it to Center Hill Cemetery with him, you know. So I was pretty dashed by that, you know. I mean, I continued to meet chairmakers, but there was not a lot of self-reflection out of a lot of folks, you know. It just this is the way my family does it, you know. And of course, the other thing is that chairmaking has gotten much more mechanized in recent decades compared to the kinds of, you know, crookback chairs that were made up until the 30s by a lot of these shops, you know. And there's still, you know, you drive around Canyon County, you still see old chairs on these farmhouse porches, you know, and you just wish the chair could talk, you know. So anyway, this really odd relationship between the chair tradition and the basket tradition is, you know, I just wound up interviewing a lot more of the basket makers, and some of this was also driven by programming. You know, when we were the featured state for the Smithsonian Festival in 1986, I was going to have some Canyon County basket making in it, and went out and kind of assessed a lot of the active makers, and was not real sure if the Smithsonian would allow me, for example, to bring a mother and a daughter. You know, we had this great Ida Pearl Davis was she was no spring chicken, but her daughter Thelma Hibden was just wonderful in facilitating things for her mother. And I thought, well, now this would be my first choice, but if they tell me we can't have two, I've got to have a younger one. You know, I've got to have somebody that can be on their own and can make the call. And Josie Jones, incredible traditional baker, but she absolutely would not talk about anything other than cash on the barrel head, you know. And she didn't want to get on any airplane, and she steadfastly refused. I tried to get her to the National. I tried to get her to all kinds of festivals over the years, and she just didn't want it. And after a while, that was okay. That's where Josie's at, you know. And she's a dear woman, but she was incredible character, would have gone over very well at a festival. But, you know, so kind of getting to understand where people were coming from, what their comfort zone was, what the limits of that might have been. That was all an interesting part of the process. And actually, back in the early 70s, there was an intervention of sorts, and it happens to have been made by a guy who was a high school classmate of mine who got an art degree and started working for the Tennessee Arts Commission at the time, Roy Overcast. There was some OEO money, Office of Economic Opportunity, back in the 70s that they latched on to a proposal to jumpstart the basket tradition and teach all these young folks their local tradition and as an economic incentive. And Maggie Murphy, this incredible character of a woman, she taught some classes, and it's very much to Roy's credit that, unlike some of the craft revival institutions, you know, it was his model for an appropriate program was to get the local makers to teach, you know, and but then he suddenly realized that Maggie wouldn't go other places. You know, he tried to get her to do all kinds of stuff, and you know, she just stayed right there at home, you know, and so he went through several others, and lo and behold, none of these women would do that. You know, why would I want to do that? I just make baskets in the backyard, you know, and so you know, he butted up against the same kind of a thing. I think his efforts, that this is my own agency now in its earlier days, Tennessee Arts Commission, they really did have some effect on reviving activity. And as I've pieced together these biographies of these women, it's pretty clear that two or three of them saw the opportunity and grabbed it. A few of them had been people that had gone off and lived in Chicago and then come back and started making baskets in the 70s, where they finally heard, you know, well, they're paying better prices for baskets, you know. And a lot of the women in the community, they were flabbergasted that Maggie Murphy had become famous. And, you know, Maggie was just this funny old gal, friend to everybody, you know, but they said, well, I could make a better basket than Maggie can, you know. And so there was, some of it was pull, you know, was a prospect of making good money off of baskets, but some of it was also push, you know. Some of it was, you know, well, I made baskets and I can do that, you know. And so there was kind of this really interesting rededication on the part of these women, and it wasn't, it just, the whole thing was not in terms that you might anticipate from the outside. It was some of it was emotional and motivated by just the challenge of doing it, you know, just a sort of a pride thing. And what was really interesting was after you know, I've had a million ventures where you try to put traditional baskets into a museum context, and by and large, people don't really, you know, they're like a good phrase is a pig looking at a wristwatch. You know, they really don't understand what's going on in that basket. But the people that did understand it were the makers, and I mean, I have sat through conversations of who's better. You know, comparison of these just incredibly fine points of, you know, how they do this part of the wrapping or what their signature splits are, that, you know, the real audience was the peer group, you know. And these women, you know, half the time you come up, start talking to them, and they'd hold up a basket. Who made it? You know, if I couldn't make an intelligent comment on who might have made that, I wouldn't worth talking to. You know, I didn't know what I was talking about. You know, so it was that dynamic was also a rite of passage for me as a field worker. You know, I had to get some smarts about identifying some of this stuff, and so it was. The art really lived at home in these rural communities and households, and you know, for all the, wouldn't it be nice if everybody could make a living off of this, or the tradition could live forever, or whatever else? The really important stuff for me, you know, I've kind of started to see it completely inverted. It is about these families, and this place. And what it still holds on in, you know, now it's grandchildren remembering their grandmother, you know.
And you've been there to help facilitate that all the way along. I've kept you on the phone way longer than I probably should have this afternoon.
Well, don't start me talking or I'll try to tell you everything I know.
I know that about you, Roby. This has just been fascinating. So just in closing, if people want to learn more about Cannon County Baskets and about your work, where can they read some more about this?
Well, we've issued the first article in the series in the Tennessee Folklore Society Bulletin. There's a website, and it's volume 66, numbers 1 and 2, which was issued as spring and fall of 2010. There's going to be a sequel article coming out, and then the mother of all articles may be further in the future, Brent and I are talking about trying to figure out some graphic way to represent the descent lines of these various families and the documentation of crafts throughout their generation. So that'll encompass both baskets and chairs if we can get the thing done. But that's where this information is written up. But even more importantly, come to Cannon County, to the Art Center of Cannon County. They have rotating exhibits all the time, and very often show things from their collection of Cannon County basketry. The Art Center, I've already said some good things about what they've done, but they also have succeeded in having a full-time folklorist. Evan Hatch has done a great job there, and he's tasked with developing a lot of the exhibits, but they're very often are shows up that have good representation of the basketry, and still a few local makers that sell baskets through their gift shop there.
I really appreciate you taking the time out, and I'm sure folks will check out more of these resources, and maybe we'll have you back on once you get some more installments of this story printed in the journal.
Great.
Thank you
Great.
Again.
Good talking to you, John.
You've been listening to Artisan Ancestors, with music by Martin Simpson and hosted by John Kay.